A true story of faith and madness on the Alaska frontier. The scene? The Wrangells, largest national park in the nation. The story? All the way back to Texas in the 1950s. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Today our subject is Tom Keziah's new book on the Pilgrim incident. Talk to Tom toll-free, 1-800-478-8255, a local call in Anchorage of 550-8422. Social media-wise, email talk@alaskapublic.org. Pilgrim's Wilderness is the subject on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
Providence Imaging Center, with its newest center in Soldotna, offering CT scans, MRI, ultrasound, and digital X-ray to residents on the Kenai Peninsula. Learn more at provimaging.com. The Alaska Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of Native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at the AlaskaNanookCommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, anyone who thinks Alaska can't turn out stories need only pick up this book, Pilgrim's Wilderness, a true story of faith and madness on the Alaska frontier. If you weren't around in Alaska when this happened and everybody was talking about it, you probably find all this unbelievable. I mean, we kind of found it unbelievable while it was happening, but it did happen, and I don't know that we even know the whole story now or ever will know the whole story, but we know a lot more now, thanks to this book by Tom Keziah, than we did before. And Tom is with us today. Tom Keziah, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hi, Steve. Thanks.
Tom lives in Homer. He's a former reporter for the Anchorage Daily News. And in that capacity, he was the reporter who traveled in rural Alaska and brought word from rural Alaska to the readers of the Daily News. There'd probably be some listeners, Tom, that will remember those years and the book that came out of that, In the Wake of the Unseen Object.
The Wake of the Unseen Object, yeah.
Which is sort of a forgotten now.
Well, it's still in print, actually.
Yeah, yeah. And that was kind of going back to that time.
Yeah, it was the beginning of the tribal reaction to the Native corporations in ANCSA, and there was a lot of political ferment going on and also a lot of lifestyle change. It was a great time to be traveling.
And people, and you were writing about people.
Right. And it was also a time when you could show up in a village and people were sort of surprised to see you show up there, and they'd say, "What's going on?" And you'd sort of get into conversations. And now I think they have a little bit more of a way to shunt you into the guest quarters and off by yourself. So it was a kind of a good time to be a traveler.
It was the 80s.
Yeah, right.
So Tom Keziah is our guest, and the book is Pilgrim's Wilderness. And Tom, this book was launched when? A week ago?
Just a week ago was when it was published.
And what do you have any feeling for what sort of splash it's making yet?
It's getting some good reviews. It's had, you know, a few reviews and seems to be doing pretty well. The big question for me was whether it could make a connection with an audience in the lower 48, you know. Especially somebody like who isn't interested in Alaska, but kind of can get drawn into a story and by the end they're interested in Alaska. That was the challenge.
Also, the challenge is it's just such a huge story with so many aspects to it. And there's a lot of research in here.
Well, I've told people
it took you a long time.
I told people it was hard to, at this stage, now that the book is coming out and I'm doing some interviews with media from the lower 48 and they asked me to say what the book is about. And I hadn't really, you know, polished that pitch, because for 3 years as I was working on it in Alaska, people would say, "What are you up to?" And I said, "Well, I'm working on the story of you know, what the inside story of the Pilgrim family, and their eyes would get wide, and they say, "Oh, I want to read that." And that was all I had to say, you know, up here.
Right.
So I didn't really get very much experience in saying what it was about.
Well, picture a listener who knows nothing about the Pilgrims, and let's see how shined up that pitch is right now.
It's not very shined.
Oh, come on.
Yeah.
You can do it faster than me, I'll bet.
Well, it started with a bulldozer in a national park. And in 2003, it kind of came to my attention. I have a cabin out near McCarthy and had been going back and forth, new people out there, and was hearing about a family that had moved out to McCarthy in the Wrangell Mountains. And they'd gotten into a fight with the Park Service at Wrangell St. Elias National Park about a bulldozer clearing project that the patriarch of this family had undertaken between a sort of abandoned copper mine that the family had settled on and the town of McCarthy, 13 miles away. He had cleared the road to get access into his place, and to the Park Service, he had just driven a bulldozer through a national park without asking anyone. And
yeah, you don't do that.
Well, yeah, but I mean, to the locals, or a lot of the locals out there, he was, you know, clearing a historic wagon road back from the Kennecott copper mining days, and there were some, you know, aspects of the creation of the national park out there in 1980 that were supposed to accommodate local use and the history of the place. And so,
and of course, we have the much referred to revised statute 2477.
Boy, I got into that the first 5 minutes. I spent all.
Well, this is Alaska. We have to bring it up, you know.
I spent, you know, 3 years trying to keep it out of the book, get it down to one sentence. So, you know, to me as a reporter, I was looking for, it was a story about, you know, the coming of modern conservation and how Alaska was going to adapt. And I'd always been fascinated by the community out there in McCarthy, the sort of self-reliant lifestyle out there. It's kind of a one of a kind place. And so I was interested in that as a story and got in touch with Papa Pilgrim, the patriarch of this family with 15 kids out there, and talked on the phone and said, and as he told me about their lifestyle and what he thought they represented and all the trappings of sort of American pioneer mythology, I said, I got to get out there and see this guy. And so we talked and tried to ingratiate one to the other, and eventually they invited me to come out, rode horseback out with the kids, spent some time, and ended up doing big profiles of the family and the fight with the park. But a lot of the attention had turned at that point to the family and their lifestyle and who are these people. And through a series of unexpected developments, I learned about his fascinating past, that he wasn't just the simple hillbilly father that he was presenting himself as. And so it was a story with some big twists and turns right from the start. And after the big profiles ran in the Anchorage Daily News, friends asked me, "Well, that was fascinating. Are you going to write a book?" And at the time I said, "There's something going on out there that we don't know yet, and I got to wait and see what the last chapter is before I think about, you know, writing something."
Oh boy,
more.
Did you ever get a last chapter? Well, the last 5 or 6 or 8?
yeah. So there were some big turns still to come, and I recognized that. And it was 2 years before the big developments took place, and at that point, it almost seemed so dark when we found out what was really going on out there on the homestead that, again, I, you know, wasn't sure that this was something, a story I wanted to tell. But in court and afterwards, getting to know the kids and hearing their story about what it was like to grow up out there in this family that became a cult and how they escaped and their resilience and strength of character, it was really, it was a great story and a surprise ending. And I thought, now this really, here's a turn that I could, you know, follow through to the end and tell a really good story. And it had, as I say, both the big Alaska frontier themes combined with the internal dynamics and fascination of this family. That's what made me think this is a story worth telling.
Bob Dylan's song, The Masters of War, the last line. Remember the last line of that song?
No.
I'll stand on your grave to make sure that you're dead.
Right.
Pretty powerful line.
Yeah.
You got a pretty powerful final line in your book, too.
Do we have to give it away?
I think we kind of do.
It was an interesting moment when I realized that was where the story should end, with, you know, putting Papa in his grave, because it whipped the rest of the book into shape in a way, really literally pinning down the last line. Everything else, it was like straightening out a hose, you know, everything else that came before changed, and realized it was about this, you know, a big part of what the book was about was this one guy's journey. You know, I started out trying to write this book as a big Alaska book, almost like John McPhee a generation later. And it was overambitious in that it was, you know, there were chapters about Alaska park politics and inholder rights and, you know, my own evolution of my own, you know, tender feelings toward Alaska wilderness and how that changed over time. And there, you know, all good stuff for me to write and work through, but I spent half the time working on this book trying to take material out of it, get it back down to fighting trim, which is where it is, I think, now.
Yeah. His Papa Pilgrim, Bobby, Robert Hale, back in the 1960s, back in the 1950s, that was a blockbuster of a story that you put out in the Daily News about this man's past. This man we knew as Papa Pilgrim, a rustic and charming. I mean, certainly charming. When you say
charismatic
charming,
and charming, very yeah, much. And yeah.
Manipulative. You could tell he was a manipulative, couldn't you, from the very beginning, in a way?
I sensed it, but a lot of people didn't. I mean, I think if he had a great way of zeroing in on what you were interested in and responding to that, so he could be a lot of things to a lot of people.
And then extremely devout.
Pious and, you know, quoting the Bible within three sentences of meeting him. You know, he was
and
right
always
there.
Carrying one around. They had quite a few, I guess the whole family had.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
a lot of Bibles.
What we didn't know is that that was all they had, was, you know, the Bible and the, you know, 17th century allegory, Pilgrim's Progress. Those were the two books in the house, and he would read them aloud.
You know, this is really interesting, because John Bunyan's book is sort of buried in history, and yet it figures very importantly, I think, in this narrative.
Well, it's not as buried as I thought initially. I mean,
people in the literary world know about it, because it's a post-Shakespearean classic of sorts.
But it's also very much in the current Christian conversation, and, you know, especially in some denominations.
And the figures of speech, even,
still
that we
read.
Use, come out of there, yeah.
Right, Vanity Fair is from there, you know, that's the evil town.
Yeah, and it is a colossal allegory. And it's very interesting to think of this compared, and I really see the King James Version of the Bible, you know, written, 60 years earlier.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that same comparison of literary style going on and boiling around in the head of this man and then propagating out to all these family members.
Yeah, they had their diction was almost a kind of King James way of expressing themselves, and you know, I loved that as a writer. It was something fresh and different, and I tried to incorporate that in the story, especially as I told their part of the story from their point of view later in the book.
Don't you think there was something to the quest for whatever it is that the wild offers, that this family in their twisted way was envisioning?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I think that it was it's something we all relate to in Alaska, and part of it was genuine, and part of it was him figuring out right away that this nostalgia about the frontier and about the rural lifestyle from before the national park was something that would play very well in his new home in McCarthy. And play well with me as a reporter at the sort of, you know, American studies graduate coming to Alaska in the 1970s and getting wide-eyed about the subject matter that I could, you know, the moment in history that I could report on as a newspaper reporter. And I think that we all responded to that. And in our own life, my wife and I had a cabin when we got married. She had this little piece of land out there near McCarthy, and we built a cabin and, you know, cleared some trees and looked out at the view and, you know, lived out there now and again, but never for very much. It was a dubious claim, definitely, to present myself as part of the community, and I didn't really do
join
that.
Join the club. There's only millions.
Yeah, yeah. But Papa Pilgrim, you know, started calling me Neighbor Tom once I told him that I had a place out near there. And so he was kind of playing me in his way, that, you know, I wasn't just a reporter and I would understand the what he was talking about when he talked about the value of their life to the rest of America, to understand that this life could still be lived in the modern age.
Okay, so you come at it from American studies, but you probably would have written a very different book, but it would have come out in some ways very much the same had you come at it from the point of view of an evangelical Christian who really thinks we may be in the last days. I think you might. I mean, this was part of it. You know, people get wacky when they think the last days are imminent. They get a little wacky. The reading of history shows us this. The Great Millerite Delusion, the Great Awakenings. I mean, if you know American studies, you mm-hmm. know these things.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow the imminence of the end it comes to justify conduct that wouldn't otherwise.
Well, what I learned in working on the book after, you know, leaving the paper to look deeper, I went down to New Mexico where they had lived as a family for several decades before coming to Alaska. And it was during that period that he was really kind of withdrawing from the real world and beginning to conceive himself as a modern day Noah, getting ready for the next disaster, whatever that might be, building shelters and seeing his family as, you know, he was going to replenish the earth or go to heaven when everyone else didn't. There was some sort of purity in their remove and withdrawal, and that carried forward into Alaska.
We could go 3 hours on this real easy, I think. I mean, I'm sure fascinated, and it seems to me that probably there's stuff that I wish you'd have left in.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, we're getting down to it here. The telephone number is 1-800-478-8255. If you'd like to join the conversation, and maybe just a shout out to Tom for all his great work out in Bush, Alaska years ago, that's okay too. 478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call, 1-800-478-TALK. A local call on Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk at alaskapublic.org. You lived in Homer for quite a long time, yes?
Yeah, I started out, came right out of college and went to work for the Homer News.
Uh-huh.
I was the editor of the Homer News, you know, when I first got started. Then worked for the Anchorage Daily News in Anchorage, and ultimately, starting in 89, split the difference and kind of had the best of both worlds, living in Homer but working for the Anchorage Daily News ever since.
Yeah, way to go.
Yeah.
And I guess this is the point where we throw this in as well, that you lost your wife in the middle of this adventure.
She died of ovarian cancer. And so, you know, I had to say a little bit about that in the book, not much, but it seemed important because she had worked, you know, for the Sierra Club and had been a environmental activist and a defender of public lands. And yet even she had succumbed to the romance of building a cabin. I mean, for her to end up being an inholder in a national park was kind of an ironic twist that adds to the picture. And also, you know, a lot of what this book is about is the faith of the family and their understanding of their own story, their own narrative being one of, you know, danger in the valley of the shadow and their redemption. And it's an amazing story, and they, you know, carried their faith out of that experience of very twisted faith that they were raised in. And yet, I don't share that faith. And so, talking about my own story and Sally's story adds, I think, a little useful perspective to the whole. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah. So it's a whole other book, really.
But it was also important to explain how it was that Papa called me, you know, neighbor Tom, and let me come out to their place and really start to find out about what was going on in the family and his own past. I mean, he kind of just blurted out something that kind of gave me the key.
Really?
Yeah.
Which was?
Well, he said when we were sitting in the one room cabin out there, he said he'd never allowed a journalist to come close to his family before.
Right, yeah.
It was partly, you know, his way of, you know, complimenting me and, you know, stroking my ego. He was so good at that. And but he said a journalist had once written something about his father that was full of lies, and he said, you know, I just, you know, never trust a journalist after that. And I sort of, you know, I was stroking his ego, right? So I'm nodding sympathetically, but I write down in my note, check on I.B. Hale, see what somebody wrote something about him one time. And so I got back to Homer and looked on the internet, and what was written about his father, I.B. Hale, had been written by Seymour Hersh, you know, one of the leading investigative reporters in America. And it was like a whole part of a big book about the Kennedy administration, and suddenly the door flew open about, you know, into Papa Pilgrim's past of affluence and in Fort Worth, Texas, and his early, you know, eloping and with, you know, do we even go there? I don't know. Do you want to start talking about
that? Oh, yeah,
that?
I think we go there, yeah. So this is not even the 60s. This is actually 50s.
This was in the 50s, and as a teenager.
This is 50s. This is before John Kennedy gets elected.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. He was, when you know, as a high school student, he eloped with the daughter of John Connally, who had, you know, become the governor of Texas, the famous governor of Texas.
Right, and as Sid Richardson plays into this, you know, you don't live in Texas not knowing the name Sid Richardson.
Yeah, yeah. Know? I mean, everybody showed up in this, you know, it was a really tragic story. You know, within 6 weeks of their eloping to Florida, Kathleen Connally was dead of a shotgun wound to the head, self-inflicted, according to the coroner's jury. Bobby Hale, Robert Hale, later Papa Pilgrim, her husband, was the only person in the room and told the story of lunging for the shotgun as she was threatening to kill herself. Her parents never had any inkling of, I mean, she was like a very bright-eyed, beautiful, charming young teenager by all reports, and yet she had somehow fallen under his spell, and he had pried her away from this very tight family, very successful family, it was a big mystery. But it seemed clear from reading the press accounts at the time that neither family really wanted to drag out an investigation. It was a one-day inquest, and then they went back to Texas, and she was buried. And LBJ canceled a lunch with former President Truman to fly home and be one of the pallbearers for her, because John Connally had run his Senate campaign at the time. He was Senate Majority Leader, and like I say, everybody kind of shows up. His father, I.B. Hale, was a great Texas hero. He'd been captain of the Texas Christian University football team.
Ooh, when they TCU yet.
When they were undefeated and yeah. National champions.
Yeah.
You know, that leaves. And then he became a FBI agent and friend of J. Edgar Hoover, by all reports, and later became head of the General Dynamics security team there for their fighter plant in Fort Worth. And that led to another story and led to the Seymour Hersh story. At one point in the early 60s, the FBI, J. Edgar, had staked out the apartment in Los Angeles of a woman named Judith Campbell, this beautiful woman who was having an affair with JFK.
It never ends. We're almost to the grassy knoll here. This is incredible.
Well, no.
We don't even have to put on a tinfoil hat. This is all real.
I think this was true. Yeah, I know. It kind of gets ridiculous. And so the FBI saw Bobby and his twin brother, Billy Hale, pull up in a Corvette registered to IB Hale and break into her apartment. And they never reported it to the police because they didn't want to blow their own stake out. But I've seen the FBI reports, and Bobby or Papa, you know, denied it when it came up.
His brother went all wacky and moved to South America and died.
Yeah, so we don't really know.
We won't hear from him either.
What happened there and what was about. And Hirsch was, you know, speculating about blackmailing the White House to get a fighter contract. So, you know, who knows? Kind of that one remains a mystery, as do a lot of things in his past.
So then he goes hippie, all right? And then he said, you know, after this, I mean, he wants out of Texas.
Yeah.
John Connally wants him out of Texas.
Well, that was the story, was that Connally told him to get out of town in a sort of very Texas way, or the Texas Rangers called him in and said, but I don't know if that
ends
was
up naming true. His kids after astronomical features, marrying a very young girl,
they got married. I mean, he'd been married several times and had other kids, but he was 33 when he met the woman who became Country Rose and the mother of the Pilgrim family.
And so they
she
go through
a
this hippie
young
phase.
Teenager runaway and, you know, very sort of in retrospect, easily molded by him. And they had been through, he'd been, you know, kind of the Zelig of the 60s. He'd been in Haight-Ashbury in rural communes and everything, and then ended up, you know, moving to the mountains of New Mexico, living the rural lifestyle. And
And then Jesus showed us. I mean, this is your classic story, you know, the hippie LSD casualty that goes Jesus freak.
After having dinner with Charles Manson, apparently.
No. You just made that up.
That's what I'm heard from several sources. But, I mean, nothing. Obviously, they wouldn't have gotten along.
Which is just getting ridiculous. We got a half hour to go. I don't know where to go after that except to take a phone call from David. Welcome to Talk of Alaska. David, you're on the air with Tom Keziah.
Hi, Tom. It's David Hale.
Oh, hi, David.
Hi. I just had one question and then one comment, and I can take my answer off the air, I guess, or whatever you can answer me here.
Yeah, good. I haven't talked to you about this book.
Yeah. The one thing that I was wondering, if you think that this book would encourage people to live the same lifestyle as my dad did.
Ah, good question. I think it might. Is that it? Are we done? Do you have another
David?
I just had one comment about the book, but I there's a lot of detail of the things that he did, and it's interesting, you know, with the end of his life. That, you know, my fear is that it will encourage families or people to do the same things that he did in his life.
David, that is extremely interesting.
I think that there's a romance of going back to the land that probably is, you know, an old impulse back to Henry David Thoreau. And I think we all somewhat as Americans can feel that. But I think that the occasion of his, you know, his fight with the park and his sort of anger that came out there is created a moment in Alaska history that kind of clarified that this is not the 19th century anymore, you know, that you can't go out and live that way anymore. So you can do elements of that. You can, you know, enjoy being out in nature and even have a rural cabin and enjoy it on the weekend, but it's going to be hard to be a pioneer like of that sort anymore.
Right. And that's the reason why I haven't supported it. That's kind of my comment about it. You know, I've read over parts of the book, and I think that I personally feel like it's a dangerous book for especially Christian homes to read. It's never a book I would want to read to my kids.
Yeah, I know. It's an off. Well, as you know far better than I do, it's an awfully tough thing to go through. But the fact that you came out the other side, I think, is inspiring to a lot of people.
David, it's certainly inspiring to me. And I want to really thank you for your call.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you very much.
Yeah, the family did not want to participate in the book. But
some would consent to interviews.
Interview, yes. Yeah. I did spend time with them individually, and it was over a 3-year period.
And also, maybe this is the point where we bring in the Buckingham family as well.
Yeah.
Because, you've also spoken with them.
Spent time with them, especially in their case.
And without them, this would have, the outcome, well, I can't imagine the outcome.
Yeah. They were the family that took in the Hale family as they were, the Pilgrims, as they were, trying to untangle themselves from the lessons that they had learned, the biblical lessons they had learned and mislearned from their father's teachings. And so very important that they had that. I think in the book I referred to them as a kind of a Christian halfway house. I mean, I don't think that a secular family could have connected with the kids at that point in their lives. But the fact that this was the Buckinghams were a very Christian and fundamentalist, family, but one that had a much more, grounded in reality, was, crucial for the kids to find their way out of the maze that their father had created.
By generosity that's phenomenal.
Yeah, bringing in a family of 17 into their cabin.
Building an addition.
Right, building a big addition. an amazing. So, but they were also, the Buckinghams were protective of the younger kids and mm-hmm. didn't think a book was going to be a great thing for them. And so, I was initially sorry that I didn't have their official, sanction. We'd gotten along well, and I hadn't pressed too hard, overly hard as a reporter in the newspaper. I was sort of patient, and that had worked out over time. The story had emerged. We had good relationship, but I realized that it would have been really difficult to write a book with their official approval, and that I was probably lucky that they had said no, because this is just my story of what happened. And, it's not their story. And really, for them to have ever tried to struggle and reach a consensus about what happened in their lives would have just been, impossible for me as a writer to try to, be the arbitrator, but difficult for them too. And so it certainly probably would have been a watered down version of something. And it also, as David said, their sense of propriety and what's right, which they draw from their lessons in reading the Bible, are very different from mine as someone who doesn't share their faith. And so I needed to be able to write about their faith in a way that was, very respectful, I think, of what they said, and also understanding how that shaped the narrative. I mean, it was crucial to understand it, but also it wasn't the whole story, at least in my view, and so I needed to be able to step back and not just tell the official story. And I had a really interesting conversation with the family recently after, the book was done, and we were talking about it in the living room, and everyone was there, and they turned and said, "Well, so Tom," I said, "what? Any questions about the book you want to ask? Feel free." And they said, "Well, yes, tell us about your own faith, Tom." And it was like, ooh, it was a good moment. I mean, a tough moment. I told them afterwards, I felt like I was a lion in a den of Daniels. It was a good.
I think that's a good point to take a break. Our guest is Tom Keziah, author of Pilgrim's Wilderness, a true story of faith and madness on the Alaska frontier, and more from our listeners after this.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
We are delving into the saga of Robert Hale and his family and their adventure in the Wrangell-St. Elias National Park and Preserve with Tom Keziah, the author of Pilgrim's Wilderness, just came out. And Tom's an experienced Alaska writer and he's been on the story for a long time, and now it's a book. Some harsh words from Bob by email and Bethel. I think it's unfortunate, he says, that you and the author are contributing to the mythology of this disgusting felon. For one thing, his name was Robert Hale, not Papa Pilgrim, such a romantic moniker for a low-life slimeball. You are really insulting genuine pilgrims everywhere. So why don't you use this guy's real name and stop playing this grifter's game? I guess it's more important to make a buck selling a book. I don't think that the family comes out very well either, as they knew about the abuse for how long and did nothing to end it. Another bus book, in my opinion. How about that?
Well, I was waiting
I don't think Bob has read the book.
Yeah.
Because I think you are trying to probe some of this that he brings up.
I think.
How could it have gone on?
Right. And, boy, there's several ways to respond. But, you know, I do think that it's a book about human resilience and the human spirit. Christian and or otherwise, as I say, that the ending of it, I think, gives it some meaning. And as the prosecutor in the case put it to me, you know, this is a story that can really help other victims of domestic abuse and sort of prisoners of their family in one way or another. Because if these kids, and especially the eldest daughter, Alicia Book, had escape what was going on when you're isolated, not only physically in the wilderness like that, but psychologically, in that they were brought up from, you know, infancy with this lesson of God's wrath waiting as soon as you step out the door. If you rebel and try to flee, you're going to lose the one thing, the only thing that really matters, which is your eternal soul. I mean, it's just an incredible grip that he had on the kids, and for them to be able to find the conscience and find their way out of that is really, it's an inspiring tale.
He had a temper. We know this. He seemed to get worse with his temper, or at least as best we can tell from the narrative, his temper maybe got worse.
Mm-hmm.
He did not hesitate to use physical abuse. Astounding degree, amounting to torture, really, at times.
Yeah,
these are facts. This is backed up by the family themselves.
The family stories, and also I found access through the public, freedom of information, to the investigative records in the case. After Papa went to prison, Papa Robert Hale, we can call him that. You know, the fact that he was, a folk hero as Papa Pilgrim for a while, became so prominent in the issues of land use and national parks, made it seem appropriate to talk. In the book, I go back and forth between referring to him as Robert Hale or Bobby Hale and referring to him as Papa Pilgrim, because when he was in this sort of role, and I'm writing about what it was like at the time.
Yeah, and also the Pilgrim's Progress.
That's who he was.
The Pilgrim's Progress book, the John Bunyan book, is extremely important in all this.
Right, and they, I guess we haven't said, but the kids had not been taught to read, and they had no literature, no movies or books,
right?
You know, really no friends that they could honestly make, right. And so they were pretty much limited in what information they were being given about the world.
I mean, he turned this large family of his into an enabling machine. I mean, for his own delusions, that's pretty obvious. I mean, you say, oh, well, maybe they're not delusions. Maybe some of this is genuine religious inspiration. I couldn't really say.
But I will also, you know, say in response to that email that it's a tough story. And it's, you know, I don't think it's a book for everyone.
No,
you
know, I don't either.
I'm not advocating. And in response to David, you know, it's not a book that I would want my children, if they were small, to read it either. I mean, it's not a book for kids.
Yeah. I'll tell you this. The first I heard about the Pilgrims was a phone call from Ray Craig.
Uh-huh.
And Ray knows that I'm sympathetic to in Holder's concerns. And he said, boy, have we got the poster kids now. You're going to go to town on this one here. And, you know, Ray was ceaselessly, promoting his in Holder's cause. And, in fact, he's got the holdings now, right?
Right. He's
brought Chuck Cushman up here a couple of times, you know, and
he was very involved in the story and in the book. He's in the book.
Yeah.
And, you know, he and the people who were closest, you know, Papa was such a great manipulator. They had no idea what was really going on. And yet they were embracing and putting him forward as a, champion of their cause. And it was tough for them, very tough, obviously, and continues to be, to find out what was really going on. And their allegiance shifted to the kids, and it didn't really, in their view, change the legal argument they were making. The fact that Robert Hale, that Papa was, you know, sort of being so feisty and picking fights, and you could sort of understand more now how that came to pass. Mm-hmm. But they felt like the underlying legal cause that they were fighting with the park didn't change because their poster boy turned out to be such a tyrant and abuser.
Let's go to Dave, joins the program from Fairbanks. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Dave, with Tom Kazaya. Sorry we held you up so long.
No, that's all right. I don't know how you cover this in your book. I haven't read it yet. But what do you think the story will do to the likelihood of any future changes to the terms of access to federal lands in Alaska?
Well, specifically, I think the case had a fairly big impact on the situation in the Wrangells. The Papa cut this bulldozer road open without asking, and it became a big court case. And eventually the federal courts did decide that the park had, you know, a legal right to insist that any family that undertakes a project like that has to come to them first and get authorized and get permits, that's part of the new regime that controls Alaska. But at the same time, or on the other hand, there was no good process for someone in the Pilgrim situation to really get their access worked out. It was a kind of an ad hoc process at that point with the park and with national parks in general. And again, we're talking specifically here about probably the most protected parts of the federal lands in Alaska, the ones that have actually been enclosed as national parks. And so, they now have a whole new access guide. And in the preamble to the access guide, which lays out, I think, a lot more clearly now how someone in their situation would go about getting a permit, they state in the preamble that the people of these parks who live in these parks have a right to be there, and that there's a value to the nation in having this lifestyle preserved, that it's not just the land but the lifestyle as well. And so I think that in the end, this fight over the Pilgrim situation, which escalated to the point of where the parks were ready to bring in a SWAT team, and it got really kind of scary for a little while there. And I think the parks really at that point were maybe overreacting and getting really kind of hepped up to make a point here. And so they backed off. I think the Pilgrim supporters have sort of found a more moderate tone. And I think, you know, it's going to be an ongoing issue in Alaska, the whole question of ANILCA, the lands bill.
It wasn't necessarily damaging. This thing was not necessarily damaging to the inholders' cause, I don't think.
I think it clarified.
Although the terms of the permits were upheld. Ultimately.
It definitely moved history forward, you know.
Yeah.
Another 10 yards, you know.
Yeah. Dave?
Yeah.
Any more?
No, thank you. That's great. Well, I guess one other thing that I think that Mr. Kazaya, my understanding is that way back in the 80s, while you were writing Wake of an Unseen Object, I think you may have stayed with my wife's family at Black River, and they've enjoyed that book quite a bit in the family for a long time, many years now.
Oh, thank you for saying that. That was a wonderful, you know, magical week out there.
Yeah. All right. Thanks very much. I'm looking forward to reading your book.
Yeah, Dave. Thanks for that. Thanks for that shout out. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922, on the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news on Alaska's business sector, government, and industry since 1985. Information and subscriptions online at akbizmag.com.
I'm going to tell our listeners right now, portions of the following may be found offensive by some family members. Our guest is Tom Kazaya, author of Pilgrim's Wilderness, A True Story of Faith and Madness on the Alaska Frontier. I'm cutting to the chase here. The reason that Robert Hale was sexually involved with his eldest daughter was because he believed he needed to be sexually aroused in order to have more children. And he couldn't be aroused by his wife, right?
That was his story, and that was what they told the troopers, yeah.
And that's your story. That's the story you put in here.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. Is this out for the first time or what?
Well, yeah. I mean, they didn't talk about that in court. Well, they never went to trial because Papa was in jail for 2 years, and they were negotiating back and forth. In the end, he finally pled out. There was never a trial, and there was 2 days where the kids were able to speak out at his sentencing and talk about what he meant. It was a very moving couple of days, and also a 3-hour soliloquy from Papa about how everybody was wronging him, and he was still right, and everyone else was wrong. So that was kind of the dramatic conclusion, but they talked about abuse, but they didn't really talk about the sexual abuse, and that's what I mean. It's not, you know, appropriate in their view to talk in public about that. But they did explain it all to the state troopers and the investigators when it came in, and eventually, so that what it meant was that the mom knew what was going on for a while. I mean, it shows the psychological control that he had of the family, that they could live in a one-room cabin, and this could have gone on for years without any of the kids really understanding what was happening to their sister and how she was protecting them by hiding the truth. And the mother's role was really tough, you know. She was terribly abused. She was, clearly a victim of the worst kinds of domestic abuse, and yet she was, you know, sacrificing one daughter's future in order to protect the rest of the family, and making that choice as a, you know, former teenage runaway who was molded by this guy. It's a really difficult situation to try to put yourself in and think about how anyone could respond. The prosecutor looked into it in depth and decided that she was not going to be prosecuted, as I spell out in the book how he thought that through. And she's struggling to look back on her life and what happened. Could she have done more? Should she have done more? I think it's easy to say yes from this point of view, and I think some of her kids feel that way too as time advances and they look back on what happened and at the things that they didn't know were happening at the time. But it was, it's just really hard to get back into that heart of darkness that they were living in. And I try in the book to some extent to convey what that must have been like.
You also portray a character that the family knew well from Pilgrim's Progress that came to really personify and symbolize Robert Hale himself.
The man in the iron cage.
The man in the iron cage.
Who?
Caged in by his own hardness.
First by his lusts and then by his hardness and his inability to ask forgiveness and to repent and to the grave. He never was able to let go of that.
That's powerful. And even in court, the way that you describe it in this book, getting towards the end, which is, it's a tough read when you get to the end. And here are the family members, and they're in court, and they still are hoping that he will repent because there's something good in the middle of this. You know, he led them. There's something good. All he has to do is admit, and he can't.
And he can't. I know. It's and they're each of them trying to find the words to bring him around. And then in his talk, he's trying to find the words to control them, and he's pressing all the buttons that he knows exist, even, you know, singing old songs of, you know, that they used to sing together. And it was an amazing moment if you knew the story.
Why did you use the word wilderness? Is that just for audience purposes?
That was part of it. But, I mean, the wilderness, it has a lot of different meanings. And
it does.
To me, it's a kind of, always been a kind of idealized word, you know, the Alaska wilderness,
yeah.
You know, that it's still untrammeled nature. And yet there's the biblical sense of it as being a wasteland.
And where St. Francis went.
A place you get lost and a place of danger and a difficult place to get out of. It just had those different levels.
You know what you have here, and you know people use this word all the time. And you know, Corey Flintoff told me one time. He says, "Will you please try and find other words besides tragedy to use for sad occasions?" He said, "Because a tragedy is a very particular type of drama. It is a drama invented by the Greeks in which the audience knows what's going to happen, and the main character does not." That's what we have here. We have a classic, a very, very classic tragedy in the classical sense.
Well, I'll let you say that. I'm not sure. I mean, to call him a tragic hero is to maybe give him...
I wouldn't say hero.
Yeah.
it works for all the villains, too.
The tragic villain. I think clearly he's the villain in the story.
Yeah,
but yeah, I think it's true that to sort of be able to go back to his beginnings and see this as, you know, his odyssey gives the book
a... Who knows? I mean, we don't even know exactly the conditions of the death of this pregnant wife of his.
Yeah, there's a lot of mystery, especially in the early years, and you know, it's kind of hard to clear up some of that.
Let's go to Bill, joins the program from Wasilla. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Bill, with Tom Kazaya.
Hi, how are you?
Very good.
I was calling with somewhat of a milder criticism of your work than a couple of the earlier callers. I haven't read your book yet. I've listened to a couple of interviews, and I really have no comment on your treatment of the family as such, but I do have a comment on your treatment of inholders' rights in national parks. I think you are engaging in an awful lot of false equivalency, which is the sort of thing that journalists frequently do. This really is not and was not as legitimate and straightforward a controversy as you're making it. It was outright clear lawbreaking from the start, and there was really no debate at the time that he had any more right to bulldoze a road through Wrangell-St. Elias National Park than I would have a right to go bulldoze a road through Yellowstone National Park. I realize there are sympathies, particularly with the end of roaders, but, you know, if I decide not to pay my taxes this year, you can find some people who think I don't have to do that either, and that doesn't make it a legitimate controversy.
Well, I think that they did have a court case that went on, you know, through the federal courts for several years trying to establish the claim and had the Pacific Legal Foundation representing them. And, you know, they had arguments on their side. I tried to lay that out, but actually, in truth, that was part of what I threw overboard in the second and third drafts of this book. I had spent a lot of time.
Yeah, but it's my understanding, right, Bill? It's my understanding. I mean, there had been a way used, and the stream had moved around. There's no way they were going to establish exactly the same route as the old road did. So then it becomes questions of access. Once they actually got hold of a valid inholding in there, which took them a while, then they did have a legal foot to stand on for getting access to it, right, Bill?
They just overdid it.
I mean, what can you do with a cat and what can't you? And it's down to things like that, isn't it?
No, it did not come down to what can you and can you not do with a cat. As the author said, they took their alleged legitimate argument to court, and the court completely disagreed with them. You know,
the court said that they should have had a permit.
Yeah, I think the way it was left.
Allowed to do what they did.
Yeah, but I think
that was the entire issue. These inholders' rights people, these land rights people, are under the impression that you don't have to go get a permit, that you can just do whatever you want when you have an inholding.
Right.
And there was never any credible argument to that extent. The fact that you have to get a permit to do something is tantamount to saying that it's prohibited. Absent a permit, it is prohibited.
No, it's not. Hey, come on, Bill. That's not true.
How is that not true?
Because the purpose of a permit is to permit something. So don't say it forbids it. Give me a break, man.
No, I think he was saying that if you don't have the permit.
The absence of a permit is a prohibition.
Right.
They didn't have a permit when they built their road. No one disputed that. Neither did or should anyone have disputed that building the road without a permit was absolutely prohibited.
Under ANILCA, they had a right to access, of access, and it could have been fly-in. It could have been some, you know, but it was up to the park ultimately.
We're not going to end this one. This is a whole other show. Tom Kazaya, I want to thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Steve.
I wish you all the best with this book.
Well, thanks. Yeah.
What's your lesson? Did you get out of it?
Oh, my lesson out of this?
Yeah.
I loved being able to find a way, you know, take the time to shape the story and tell it in a way that makes it a compelling story, as compelling to read as it was to live through.
You lived with it for a long time, didn't you?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thanks again. It's Talk of Alaska. Dave Waldron and Josh Edge run a crew. And I'm Steve Heimel. Thank you so much for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Providence Imaging Center, helping cancer patients stay in Anchorage with a PET scanner that fuses anatomical and functional images since 2004. Learn more at provimaging.com. And by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.